From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. A spectacular photo book landed on my desk recently with two snowy egrets on the cover, an extravagance of fluffy plumes balanced on long black spindles. The book is titled simply Waterbirds. The photographer is Theodore Cross. He's 85, and he only came to love birds and photographing them in midlife. Mr. Cross has had a long career in law and publishing. He's an expert on black economic development, but birds, well, they are his passion. And he's traveled hundreds of thousands of miles to find them, whimbrels and godwits, auklets and plovers and puffins. Theodore Cross's quest for a bird called the Red Knot took him 600 miles north of the Arctic Circle. He could have stayed home in New Jersey to see the Red Knot in migration, but he wanted to find it nesting.
The bird nests in the tundra. It's well disguised. It's well camouflaged. But it's a gorgeous, gorgeous creature. It's probably one of the most exciting birds in my life. And I've spent a lot of time with it.
Its migration takes it from Patagonia all the way up to the high Canadian Arctic, 8,000-mile flight.
Yeah, it goes up further than the others.
Well, how did that quest for finding the nest of the Red Knot, how did that work out?
It was a long 7-day journey. We just marched the tundra until we finally saw one.
Let's describe the Red Knot. She's a pretty thing.
Yeah, there's a good picture of her there. Actually, in South America in the winter, she's a very, very dull sort of mousy brown bird when she's down there. But then she starts flying. And say in maybe April she leaves. She's flying across the great mountains of Brazil, thousands of miles, and she turns this beautiful red russet. She's a Cinderella bird. She turns into something absolutely gorgeous when she arrives in New Jersey. But they are truly gorgeous, and they have this tremendous courage and determination. You know, they have a little heart and lungs about the size of an end of a pencil, and it pumps away for 8,000 miles until they get to where they're going. It's the courage of these guys that appeals to me tremendously.
Huh. Now, why do you think that is?
I don't know. I don't know. It is the... You know, the perching birds can be quite beautiful, but the water birds have courage, they have beauty, they do fantastic acrobatics. I remember as a little boy, I marveled when a woman named Gertrude Ederle swam the English Channel, and I adored that woman for years and years and years. But you compare her feet with what a Red Knot does, and, you know, it diminishes its importance.
Mr. Cross, you write in the beginning of this book that you spent many, many years not noticing birds at all. So when did this take over? When did this become a passion for you?
It's a strange thing. I was in the Navy for 2.5 years in the Pacific, and our beat was to travel from Ulithi to these little islands out there. They're really quite big islands. Now, at the time, I know there were millions of birds around me all the time. And I didn't notice them. I was 18 years old. Of course, at wartime, you have other things to notice, like being seasick or having some terrible disease in your armpit. I was totally ignorant of birds, didn't care one bit. Then whammo, 20 years later, there may have been some sort of a subliminal effect that these guys had on me. I don't know. But they became a very important part of my life. It's like a disease, I suppose. It's a disease like golf, except for family and friends. There's few things I care more about.
I can tell you have a special place in your heart for the reddish egrets, and there are some just stunning pictures of them here in this book that you took in Texas on Green Island. And there's one, I swear, this bird looks like Phyllis Diller. It's got this incredible white plumes of feathers all the way down the head and
well,
long neck.
That's interesting, Phyllis Diller.
I
think of the mad woman in the attic, hair going in all sorts of directions. Yeah, they're one of my favorite birds, maybe the best. And probably 80% of them are congregated in a little island off South Texas. And I've been going there every blasted year for 30 years. The island is loaded with rattlesnakes. What happens is the rattlesnakes wake up in the winter, and the eggs of the birds appear, and the rattlesnakes have a feast. But despite the rattlesnakes and water moccasins, I've been down there faithfully every year to see this crazy bird. And that's one of the great birding experiences of the world. You know, if you have snake guard boots and all the paraphernalia you need to travel in that kind of environment.
You write about the feeding dance that the reddish egrets do. Tell me about that.
Yeah, they do this marvelous feeding dance. They run around acting like drunken sailors. They throw up their wings to create a shade so that the fish think it's sanctuary, and it isn't sanctuary, it's death, because then the reddish egret can see the fish. And it just goes absolutely wild. There's no other creature on earth that goes through those gyrations.
I keep coming back to a picture of, this is a beautiful bird, a white tern, a delicate, all white.
Oh, isn't that
black
cute?
But here's
cute
the thing that
guy.
Gets me. Yeah, really, really cute.
Yeah.
They lay their eggs not in nests. They just, they lay them on a tree branch, and they're just sort of, there's a picture of the bird sitting right next to the egg, and you just know that egg has a really good chance of falling off or getting eaten. It's, there it is.
Sure. Well, you get a good windstorm, and that egg will go. And they just lay another one. You know, they're very pragmatic. They became quite famous during the war because the Marines adored them. They're on every island in the Pacific. And if you come in a boat, the fairy terns will come out and greet you. They're very curious. In the case of the Marines, these silly little guys would insist on nesting on the gun emplacements. Leaving an egg on the gun emplacements. And the Marines would simply remove the egg, put it in a tree or in a safe place, fire the gun, and then put the egg right back where it was. So they became absolutely adored by the Marines during the war. There was a lot of poetry dedicated to the white. They're now called the white tern. It used to be the fairy tern.
You write in the introduction that you keep thinking in your mind about these magical islands of birds that you've seen. And you say this, memories of them help me accept the brevity of the time that lies ahead.
I think of so many of my friends. They go on a trip to Italy. They're sitting in before some magnificent building. And maybe their wives are there too. The wives are talking about the architecture, and the men are talking about their former careers, and they have no fallback at all. I'm a great arguer for having collateral activities in addition to what you do, and maybe I'm a bit of a goody-goody and trying to change other people, but it certainly does get you through the difficult years of approaching what is going to happen. And why I do it, I don't know. I don't know, but I get enormous pleasure from it. It is a way of dealing with the expectation of death.
Well, Mr. Cross, I wish you many, many happy birding days ahead. Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you. That was very enjoyable.
And you can find some of Theodore Cross's photos from his book, Waterbirds, on NPR's photo blog, The Picture Show. That's at npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Democratic leaders in the Senate are heading into what they hope will be its final days of debate on a health overhaul bill. President Obama weighed in again yesterday. He invited all 60 members of the Senate Democratic Caucus to the White House to urge them to settle their lingering differences and approve the bill before Christmas.
Now, let's be clear. The final bill won't include everything that everybody wants. No bill can do that. But what I told my former colleagues today is that we simply cannot allow differences over individual elements of this plan to prevent us from meeting our responsibility to solve a longstanding and urgent problem for the American people.
In a moment, we'll hear how the president is dealing with the reality of living in a more partisan Washington than he intended. First, here's NPR's Julie Rovner with the latest in those efforts to settle outstanding problems in the Senate's health bill.
The Senate overcame a nearly week-long delay last night when it defeated a pair of amendments that would have allowed individuals, pharmacies, and drug wholesalers to import lower-cost prescription drugs from other industrialized countries. The main proposal was offered by North Dakota Democrat Byron Dorgan.
I have a beef with an industry that decides they're going to overcharge the American people, in some cases 10 times more, some cases five, double the price that is paid in other parts of the world for the identical drug. I don't think that's fair, and I don't think we should allow it to continue.
The idea has long enjoyed bipartisan support in Congress and longtime opposition from the prescription drug industry, which worries about lost profits. It's also been uniformly opposed by whichever party is in charge of the Food and Drug Administration, which has expressed concerns about being able to keep counterfeit drugs out of the country. So it wasn't that surprising when it failed to win the 60 votes it needed to pass under a Senate agreement. What was expected to pass, though, was the amendment offered instead by New Jersey Democrat Frank Lautenberg. It would have allowed drug imports, but only if they were certified as safe by FDA officials.
As much as we want to cut costs for consumers, we cannot afford to cut corners and risk exposing Americans to drugs that are ineffective or unsafe.
Amendments like those have passed the Senate several times over the past decade, and they haven't meant much because no federal official has been willing to make such a safety certification. Dorgan called out his colleagues on just that point.
Do not vote for this amendment and go home and say you've done something about the price of prescription drugs, because your constituents will know better.
And for the first time ever, the watered-down importation amendment didn't pass either, which actually takes a hurdle out of the way. But there are still plenty left. One lingering problem is how to make liberals happy now that it appears that both a government-sponsored insurance plan and a proposal to let those not quite old enough for Medicare buy into the program will be dropped from the bill. One possibility was to require insurance companies to spend a specific amount of each premium dollar on actual medical care, as opposed to administration or marketing or profits. But there's a problem with that proposal, too. Over the weekend, the Congressional Budget Office effectively squashed the proposal. It said it would basically represent a government takeover of the private insurance industry. What is still being actively negotiated is a way to satisfy anti-abortion Democrats. Pennsylvania Democrat Bob Casey, who opposes abortion, is one of the lawmakers working to find compromise on the contentious issue. He says one possibility is to add language that would expand services to pregnant teenagers and young women to help them keep their babies.
It's one of those rare policy areas where you have people on both sides of the divide on abortion who are going to be very supportive of and have been. But we want more than support. We want to get it in the bill.
Assuming Democrats can get their forces together, they'll need at least 6 days for all the procedural votes to get the measure to a final conclusion. That means they pretty much have to tie things up today or tomorrow if they want to finish before Christmas. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
For a look at how individual Americans are coping with serious health care issues, NPR's Robert Krowich has made a series of short videos, and you'll find them at our website, npr.org.
Sexting is a provocative word for a relatively new activity that teens do and get in trouble for. They send sexually suggestive or nude photos over a cell phone. A new study by the Pew Research Center finds nearly one in six teens has received these pictures. NPR's Laura Seidel reports that educators and lawmakers are struggling with how to deal with sexting.
The study showed that only 4% of teens between 12 and 17 actually send suggestive photos. 15% say they've seen sexy photos on phones.
That doesn't actually even take into account teens who see it over somebody's shoulder, who hear about it in the hallways of the school.
Study author Amanda Linhart.
Teens told us that this is something they have quite a bit of experience with. This is part of their daily lives.
Schools and communities are struggling to stop sexting. Law enforcement has been stepping in. Linhart worries they've been overreacting. She points to the case of Philip Alpert. When he was 18 years old, he had a fight with his 16-year-old girlfriend one night. In a fit of rage, he forwarded a naked photo of her to their friends and family. Alpert was prosecuted and found guilty of sending out child pornography. At 19, he's now a registered sex offender.
It doesn't make sense that somebody who's done what he has done would actually be listed on a public listing along with rapists and other people who harm people and children in ways that are so much greater.
In another case, a group of 13-year-old girls took pictures of themselves at a slumber party, dressed only in bras and towels. The photos made their way to the local district attorney. He threatened them with prosecution, and now the ACLU is suing the DA for violating the girls' First Amendment rights. ACLU attorney Vic Volchak.
What kids are doing today is no different than what they were doing 10, 20, 40 years ago. What's different is the technology has changed, and it's now more visible.
The parents won their case in federal district court, but prosecutor George Skamanek is appealing. NPR could not reach Mr. Skamanek. A few state legislatures are trying to make more appropriate laws. Vermont and Utah downgraded the penalties for minors and first-time perpetrators of sexting. But the real battle may be trying to get teens to think before they act. As DA Skamanek pointed out in an earlier interview, sexting can be dangerous. Two girls killed themselves after naked pictures leaked out at their schools, and they were taunted by peers. Recently, LG Electronics started a YouTube campaign with James Lipton, the host of Inside the Actors Studio. Lipton stands by a teenage boy who's about to send out an erotic phone picture of himself to his girlfriend Zoe.
Zoe is a Twitter addict, and the last thing he needs is tweets about his beats. Before you text, give it a ponder.
Getting teens to think before they act is a fight that's gone on for generations. Unfortunately, in this digital age, it may be taking on a new urgency. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Our critic at large, John Powers, has some recommendations for your holiday gift giving, movies and TV series on DVD.
When you watch as many movies and DVDs as I do, I'd be terrified to know exactly how many. It's only natural that people ask if I know of any good gift DVDs for the holidays. I always say that the best ones are seldom recent hits, which tend to have the life expectancy of mayflies. A good gift DVD should transport you into a different world that you can immerse yourself in over and over. That's why I begin by recommending Zeitgeist Films DVD of Topan, perhaps my favorite movie this year, which is set on the steppes of Kazakhstan. Now, don't groan. This isn't some joyless documentary. It's the hilarious, vibrantly alive story of a young man returned from the sea who wants to marry a local girl, move into a yurt, and set up his own sheep farm on some of the most forbidding real estate on Earth. Brilliantly made by Sergei Dvortsevoy, Topan isn't just a beautiful, life-affirming tale, but a breathtaking portrait of human beings and their amazingly choreographed animals, with one foot in the present, the other in 2000 BC. You enter a very different world in my next recommendation, the box set of Foyle's War Series 1-5, From Dunkirk to VE Day. It's a British TV series about a police detective superintendent in the English town of Hastings during World War II. When I got it, I feared it would be corny old stuff, but these mystery stories instantly sucked me into their embattled mood. Foyle's War reveals things about wartime England I'd never seen before. The luxurious country hotels where rich Londoners went to escape the bombs that the poor could not. Or the secret military factories where they built all the coffins. What makes the whole thing irresistible is Michael Kitchen's enthralling performance as Foyle, who in his reticence, sly humor, and triumphant decency is our fantasy of the ideal Englishman. In contrast, my next choice is the purest Americana. It's the 70th anniversary Ultimate Collector's Edition of The Wizard of Oz, our greatest homegrown fairy tale, a fable about dreams and humbug, which insists that there's no place like home. Except that home is black and white, and Oz is Technicolor. Now, I know that you've seen the movie, but this is a package worth owning. It's got a gorgeous transfer of the film in DVD and Blu-ray, fantastic extras, including the fun earlier screen versions of Frank Baum's story, and even a commemorative green Wizard of Oz watch so nifty that I'm wearing it right now. It's telling me to speed things up, but not before we enjoy a few strains of our unofficial national anthem.
Somewhere over the rainbow,
At the end of the rainbow is this year's pot of gold, AK-100, Criterion's 25-disc collection of films by Akira Kurosawa, in honor of the centenary of the great Japanese director's birth early next year. It's simply a marvel. Not only does it offer four rare films never before on DVD, it contains disc after disc of classics by one of those filmmakers whose work isn't just great, which can often mean boring. It's as entertaining as the best of Hollywood. The world that Kurosawa transports us to is Japan, and I'm not sure any director has ever covered more aspects of any country's history. Kurosawa gives us rollicking samurai stories like Yojimbo and the Seven Samurai, and ravishing historical pageants like Kagamusha. He gives us action adventures like The Hidden Fortress, one of the inspirations for Star Wars, and a heartbreaking political drama like No Regrets for Our Youth, a masterpiece about the wife of an anti-fascist dissident. He does a Japanese version of Macbeth, but also puts a Tokyo spin on an Ed McBain crime novel in the riveting High and Low. He makes movies about women factory workers in World War II, about daily life in the slums in the 50s, and in one of his greatest films, Ikiru, he tells the tale of a dying bureaucrat who doesn't want to have lived meaninglessly. It ends with a shot in the snow that's one of the most haunting in movie history. AK-100 is an expensive gift. It's nearly $300 online. But it offers more than 50 hours of pleasure if you watch each film only once. And I'm betting you'll watch your favorites far more often than that. This isn't just a collection of discs. It's a box full of treasure.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue, and he writes the blog Absolute Powers for Vogue.com. Here's some other DVDs from this year that he recommends. Season 1 of the TV series Breaking Bad, about a dying chemistry teacher in the crystal meth business. The 1969 film Downhill Racer, starring Robert Redford. The silent film The General, starring Buster Keaton. The college football documentary Harvard Beats Yale, 2929. The Swedish vampire film Let the Right One In. And the 30th anniversary edition of the Australian film My Brilliant Career. You'll find his complete list on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.
Our small business series continues today from Cucina's Deli in Salt Lake City. The restaurant's sales are down, but profits are up. The owner came up with a creative marketing promotion, or rather a stock market promotion, from member station KUER. Jenny Brundine has the story.
Dean, where do you want these?
It's 9:30 in the morning, but the pace is already starting to pick up behind the counter at Cucina's Deli. Servers deftly prepare curry chicken salads and red-peppered spicy ham sandwiches. The catering orders are starting to pile up.
I took out the first one at 6:45 this morning and hadn't stopped.
Owner Dean Perot says a year ago, it was a different story. November, then December, then January, sales plunged 35%.
That the hell scared out of me.
Perot's brainstormed. He never liked gimmicks or promotions. But by spring, the recession was getting people down. What about free coffee on Mondays? He had to tie it to something, though. The Dow. All would be right, right? When the Dow hit 10,000. How about free coffee and lattes on Mondays until that harbinger of good fortune arrived?
It's all free. And I just wanted to do a promotion that was so good, it made people suspicious.
Perot's estimates they served 22,000 cups of free coffee. He and his chef Penny Murphy added a green theme. You had to bring your own cup.
And that actually became fairly comical as people bringing in beer steins, people bringing in camelbacks. But Mondays was a circus. It was really funny, and it was really successful. And
we saw people that we'd never, ever seen their faces before.
Most people always bought something to eat as well. Perot's tracked the Dow on a big graph painted on the wall, a thick red line designating the 10,000 mark. The promotion worked, with new faces becoming regulars and boosting sales. Still, that wasn't enough, and manager Shelley Walquist had to cut employee hours.
Everyone had a hard time at first, but we tried to do it in an even way, and you know, maybe everyone took back about 5 hours a person, and slowly we've gained that back, and we've been doing a little bit better.
The 30 part-time employees are busier, and there's been no turnover for an entire year. That's unheard of in restaurants.
Takes caramelized walnuts and blue cheese.
Jeff Murphy also scrutinized food purchases. No more lemons would go bad. She watched more carefully.
I order usually 60 pounds of salmon. I can see that the salmon isn't turning over. So you order, you go back to like 30 pounds. Just you know, keeping an eye on what's selling, what's not selling.
Some customers weren't touching the piece of bread on the side of their plate. Now servers ask if the customer wants it.
Hibachi roll, 17 cents. It adds up.
Sales are still slightly down at Kachina's, 8%, but profits are up. Perot says the recession made him more efficient. He recalls a conversation with a client, also a small businessman.
I said, up until a year ago, there's a lot of things that you'd never even crossed your mind. But in essence, I bet that your sales are down. He said, yep. I said, I bet your profitability is probably up a little bit because you've had to make drastic cuts with regards to, you know, your product and your people.
Kuchina's is a second home to Robert Brusser, who enjoys a cup of coffee while reading his beloved Scientific American. He keeps an eye on the Dow and has an idea for Perot's.
Well, I think that every time it goes back below 10,000, you ought to bring back the free coffee.
But since the Dow hit 10,000 in October, customers just might be able to afford their own coffee. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brendine in Salt Lake City.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Africa contributes the least to global warming, but stands to suffer the most. That's the case African leaders are making in Copenhagen. They're demanding a higher reduction in emissions by industrialized countries and more money to help them cope with climate change. NPR's Ophabia Quist-Arkton reports from Senegal on the divide between the politics of climate change in Africa and the reality.
All scientific prognoses show that the continent of Africa will be severely hit if we do not act now.
In this video played at the Copenhagen summit, Nobel Peace Laureate and South African anti-apartheid hero Archbishop Desmond Tutu echoes the concerns of many that Africa will suffer most from the consequences of climate change. Frustration over the pace of negotiations in Copenhagen prompted the African delegation to lead a five-hour boycott of the conference yesterday. Sudan's Lumumba Stanislaus de Apping is the chief negotiator for the large and influential G77 bloc of developing countries, plus China, which took part in the walkout. He told the BBC that the row showed how deep the divide remained between rich and poor.
There is an ever-widening gap between developed countries and developing countries, because developed countries have accepted that condemning Africa, condemning the small island states, condemning developing countries to destruction and massive suffering is something acceptable to them.
African leaders have united over climate change in a way unusual for the continent, where national interests often trump continental concerns. Environmentalists say coastal erosion, desert encroachment, drought and floods, for instance, will only make life harder for Africa's impoverished population. However, developments in Copenhagen haven't attracted that much media attention here in Dakar. Minyel Tal is a Senegalese environmental activist.
I couldn't feel any engagement from the civil society here in Senegal. And even if they see that their environment is degraded, it's like, well, that's the way it's supposed to be, and, well, somebody will take care of it, but it's not our responsibility.
It's in places like this, at Rufisque, outside Dakar, that you see the effects of coastal erosion. It's one of the problems here in Senegal, which has a coast that goes from Saint-Louis in the north right to Ziguinchor in the south. And erosion is a problem in many parts.
La Dame Baye comes from the Lebo fishing community in Rufisque. Forlornly, sitting on the seawall overlooking the Atlantic Ocean, she laments the fact that the waters have swallowed up most of the beach. Mbaye said this is where she used to play as a girl. This is where my children played soccer, she said, right here on this beach. This is where our mothers and fathers, our aunts and uncles gathered to settle fishing village problems. But the ocean has eaten up the shore. There was room for everyone, she said. There were houses right here. Now they're all gone. In Copenhagen, Ambassador De Apping of the G77 stressed that President Barack Obama and the United States mustered the necessary will for the financial bailout, so the president must now do the same to fight climate change.
First of all, he has to increase his reductions by more than the current number, which is really 4%. 4% would not save Africa. The world needs a few $100 billion. He can enable that to happen the way he did in the financial crisis. We know that he cared for the Wall Street. He gave them the trillions. Let him say now he cares for the children of the world.
As global heads of state, including President Obama, prepare to gather in Copenhagen, the African delegation is driving home that message. Ofer Bjerquist-Arkton, NPR News, Dakar.